This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In the 19th century and into the 20th century, Germany was on the rise as a power in science and technology. In the first two decades of the 20th century, German nationals captured more than half the Nobel Prizes awarded in the natural sciences and medicine. But in 1933 came a new regime, and science was to serve the new order. Historian, author, and journalist John Cornwell's new book looks back at this period of history and its lessons. His latest book is Hitler's Scientists, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact. John Cornwell is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us. Join us with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. If you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. John Cornwell is in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge University. He's also a contributor to the Sunday Times Magazine and New Scientist. He is the author of numerous books, including Breaking Faith and Hitler's Pope. His latest book, Hitler's Scientists, is published by Viking. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cornwell, good afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Celeste. It's my pleasure.
Your book concludes with a look at where we are today, and that's where I'd like to begin. Would you share with our audience your thoughts about the relevance of this history for us?
Well, the remarkable thing about scientists as opposed to other kinds of academic discipline, you know, like historians and people in literary fields, is their huge dependence on funding. This means that the relationship between a working scientist and what I would call the proprietors of science, which tend to be governments and institutions like the National Institutes of Health, and the big companies like the pharmaceutical companies, is one of enormous dependency. Now, there's a connection between the problems, the moral problems of scientists under Hitler, when the proprietorship of science was taken over by the Nazi regime, which tried to shape science to its own ends, and the proprietorship of science from 1945 to the present day. And of course, our interest is with the West and under democracy, because there's been a kind of myth that democracies are the best of all possible worlds for scientists. And yet we know that not to be the case, that scientists have their research programs and their endeavors and their goals very largely shaped by the proprietors of science. Today, we're some years, 14 years beyond the fall of the Berlin Wall. One would have hoped for a new era in which scientists would have been much more free to make their own goals and shape their own programs. But since 9/11, we've found that science once again has become circumscribed by secrecy and by the favoring of funding towards those aspects of science which help war or intelligence and so forth. So those are the connections, and I think that it's a very good starting point, I think, for any discussion of this book.
Yeah. The book is just out, but I'm curious, what kind of discussion have you had with scientists about it?
Well, in Europe, where the book came out first, there's been a kind of sense of shocked agreement. 20 or 30 years ago, a scientist would, if you'd asked a scientist, how much time do you spend writing out your grant proposals, you know, your applications to get funding, they probably would have said zero. Funding of science 20, 30 years ago was much less than it is now, and the money was always there on the table. Nowadays, scientists will tell you that they spend between 50 and 75% of their time trying to get money to do science. And this comes back immediately to, you know, the problem of dependency. And I think all scientists see this to be the case. They deplore it because one of the most important aspects of good science is what we call serendipity. It's, you know, what, the things that you discover by chance. You need to have the freedom to make mistakes. What a grant proposal does when you're too dependent on your funding is that you write out a script, you know, as to what you're going to find, and that script gets nuanced in such a way as it will attract, you know, investment and funding, you know, a return on your work. Scientists hate this. Scientists want to be more free. And so, you know, my discussions with scientists have been, you know, on the whole, they've applauded what I'm doing. But, you know, there's less agreement. There's a great deal of unhappiness from philosophers of science. Now, these are the people who spend their lives looking at you know, the ethics of science. And there's been, ever since the beginning of the 20th century, a kind of myth, which is that science is essentially apolitical, value-free, and excuse me.
Yes, I can. I hear there's some disturbance in the background. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yes. Let me reintroduce our guest while he asks that a radio nearby be turned down. I think that's what's going on there. John Cornwell is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Hitler's Scientists, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact, the publisher Viking. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller waiting on line one, and we're going to get to that caller in just a moment. Let's go back to John Cornwell, and hopefully things are better there.
Hello?
Yes. Are you there? Hi. We're talking about the myth of scientists and their work, that it is morally and culturally neutral.
Yes. There's a tradition that goes back to the early 20th century that, and it really came out of some... I think, excuse me.
John Cornwell, our guest this afternoon, and we're going to get to our caller here in just a moment. It's live radio. These things happen. Let me tell you a little bit more about John Cornwell. He is in the Department of History and Philosophy of Science at Cambridge University. He's also a contributor to the Sunday Times magazine and New Scientist. He's the author of many books, including Breaking Faith and Hitler's Pope. His latest book is Hitler's Scientist, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact. Mr. Cornwell?
Hello.
Hi. It's live radio. These things happen.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to continue.
Oh, dear. Well, hello?
Hello.
Hi. What's the difficulty? Are we going to have to reschedule or what?
I hope it's going to be all right now, but in a neighboring studio, they've been putting through the broadcast into this one, so I can't hear you, but I hope this will be all right now.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to that idea of the myth of morally and culturally neutral science.
Yes, I think the problem was in started in Germany when there were clashes between different ideologies which were trying to hijack science. And so the view developed that science would be able to conduct itself much better if it simply regarded itself as outside of the political domain. And this grew into being outside of the ethical domain as well. And it was based, too, on the notion that, you know, at the level of molecules and atoms, there are no ethics, there are no politics, that water boils at the same temperature in Peking as it does in London, and that therefore, you know, science could become cocooned into a kind of apolitical, amoral world where the consequences were to do with other people, not to do with scientists themselves. You know, the consequences of discovery were down to those who were applying them.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us, so let's go and talk with this caller in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, I just wanted to discuss a couple examples here on this campus. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read your book yet. 25 years ago, I started here as an assistant professor with another young assistant professor of physics by the name of Larry Schmar, who was actively engaged as the head of the Prairie Alliance Against Nuclear Arms. And he invited me into the group. We worked very hard against nuclear weapons, against nuclear deterrence, disarmament, et cetera. Then the university invited Larry to run their National Center for Superconducting Supercomputer Applications and ordered him that if he wanted the job, he had to say nothing at all about his nuclear work and stop it, which he did do. Well, okay, fine. Years later, a professor in the political science department here got a grant from the Pentagon to use Larry's center, computing center, to model the next generation of ICBM nuclear weapons delivery devices. In other words, the cutting edge of the arms race here nationally. And what happened? Larry Schmar, starting out just as much an anti-nuclear guy as I was, sent in the cover letter supporting this in the strongest terms possible. I read it myself. It really revolted me and turned my stomach. We have other examples. For example, on this campus, the veterinary medicine program took two contracts for the Department of Defense to develop biological weapons. They, when I blew the whistle on this, they denied it. I then got the, through Freedom of Information Act request, I actually got the contracts, and sure enough, they were clearly listed by the Pentagon as biological weapons contracts. Third, we have three professors on this campus who have taken contracts from the Central Intelligence Agency, CITES and ZINNES in political science, to develop an AIDS computer model for the spread of AIDS in third world countries. I guess the CIA is interested in spreading AIDS in third world countries. That's all I could conclude. And Donchin, who was head of the psych department, our distinguished psych department, had a grant from the CIA to develop a better lie detector test for the CIA using students as guinea pigs to develop the lie detector test. And in a debate we had on this, the university admitted it was getting 51 cents on the dollar for every penny these individuals brought in. So the university itself has a vested economic interest in all of these contracts. I personally don't see how the CIA contracts or the bioweapons contracts could have gotten through the university's review committees that are supposed to apply ethical standards in research when it comes to human beings and animals. But it did, and it seemed to me the reason being the university was just going to make so much money. If you're having a look at the wire services today, apparently the University of Illinois sold off genetically engineered pigs as food. Personally, my experience being on this campus for 25 years, scientists could not care less about ethics or law or human rights. It's all about politics, money, prestige, awards, prizes, etc. And maybe not all that much different from the way it was in Nazi Germany. Thank you.
Wow. That's all I can say to that. I mean, that is a tremendous proof, I think, of precisely the thing I'm talking about. I guess one of the questions that arises from that is, well, first of all, why should scientists feel in this way? And namely, that they don't care about ethics and politics. And that points up, you know, this long tradition, this pernicious myth, you know, that science has nothing to do with politics and morals. The other question it raises, I think, is what can be done about it? And I think that one of the problems, particularly in the West after 1945, with the great takeover of science by the industrial military complex and the rise of what some people call big science, is that the scientist increasingly felt that he or she was a very small cog in a huge machine, and therefore there was nothing they could do about it, even if they were one of these isolated people who felt that something should be done, and they were involved in the consequences of their discovery of knowledge. And I think that what we have now, which wasn't in existence in Nazi Germany, was the use of IT. Websites and so forth can now form communities and constituencies of scientists to act as whistleblowers, as non-governmental organizations who are capable of challenging through the internet and the media all these issues, which are tremendously important and growing every day. I do congratulate that listener. That was a very good contribution, I think, to this debate.
What do you think, though, about the generalization that no scientists are interested in acting morally?
Yes, I think that that's probably an overstatement. Yeah. I think it's true up to a point, because they do feel helpless. I think there are too many examples of people, you know, who have stood out against the trend. There were individuals in Nazi Germany who did, but remaining with science within the West, there is an example, and I mention it in Hitler Scientists, of one very brave scientist who went to Los Alamos to do research on the first atom bomb. His name was Joseph Rotblat. He's still alive today at the age of 94. Now, Rotblat is one of the scientists who says, you know, you are a scientist, you are a human being first and a scientist second. You know, you must feel a sense of responsibility for the consequences of your science. He justified, like many of the scientists at Los Alamos, the work on the atom bomb as a deterrent. Scientists knew at the time that Hitler had an atomic bomb program in process under Werner Heisenberg in Germany. And they thought there was a distinct possibility that the Germans were not only abreast of the American and British research, but in fact were even ahead of them. Nuclear fission was first discovered in Germany, after all. Now, when in the December of 1944, the Allied troops arrived in Germany and could see for themselves the state of the research in under the Nazis, they realized that they had not got an atomic bomb and were nowhere near developing one. Now, Joseph Rotblat was an example of somebody who immediately resigned as a result of that knowledge. Another example is, of course, Joe Weigand, who's case has been much publicized through the movie The Outsider and the CBS documentary 60 Minutes on his case. Here was a man who blew the whistle on his tobacco company, which had research which indicated the addictiveness of cigarettes, but which was hiding it. And Weigand, despite tremendous pressures on his family, you know, he was going to lose his medical health, his benefits and so forth, nevertheless publicized this case to great detriment. So it's not true to say that all scientists feel like this, but I can understand the idea that scientists seeing themselves as very small cogs and powerless and tremendously dependent on the proprietors of science, you know, often feel that there's very little they can do about it.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This was the first caller. I just wanted to clarify my comment by no scientists. I meant no scientists on this campus. I did not mean nationwide. I've been on this campus for 25 years, and I make that statement. I've worked with large numbers of them. But in any event, there are scientists who do care. I'm counsel to an organization called the Committee for Responsible Genetics, headquartered out on the East Coast, and we have some of the best life scientists in the world against biological weapons, genetically engineered food, eugenics, you name it, they're involved in it. Very ethical scientists. The problem here is on this campus. I mentioned the case of Larry Smarr, the head of our NCSA, Donchin, the chairman of our psych department, on the payroll of the CIA, Seitz and Zinnes, the whole vet med program. The whole political science department was on the take for those CIA contracts. This is all about money. These people have choices. They are not cogs in some machine. They are going for the money, and the university encourages them, this university, because the university gets 51 cents off of every dollar brought in here, which they claim as overhead. And the so-called committee set up to vet these contracts in accordance with ethical standards are completely compromised. They couldn't care less. As long as the money comes in, they don't care. But I'll give you an example. You were mentioning the development of nuclear weapons. Several years ago, I was invited to give a lecture over at the College of Engineering on ethics of engineers, which I did. And I didn't get into the question of engineers developing, you know, just conventional weapons, but I talked about the ethics of engineers involved on nuclear weapons. And in the lecture, of course, I mentioned the very famous Zyklon B case rising out of the Nuremberg prosecutions, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And I applied this to engineers involved in the research, design, and testing of nuclear weapons, and that this could create accomplice liability on their part, and therefore, whatever they do with their careers, they should not at all get involved with nuclear weapons. Well, of course, the students were stunned. They had never heard of anything like this. The professor who invited me was quite upset. And I was never invited back again to give that or any other lecture in the Department of Engineering. So my experience is it's all over this university. They care about money, power, prestige, and they are not cogs in a machine here. They're going for the money, the glory, the prestige, the Nobel Prizes, et cetera. Thank you.
Well, I think that's an extraordinary proof, I think, of what we're saying here today. Mm. Yes.
Other points of view are invited. You can join us with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, historian and journalist John Cornwell. We're talking with him about his new book, Hitler's Scientists, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I didn't know that this interview was going to go off in this direction totally. I thought we would touch on it, but because of where we began and because of the extremely troubling examples that our caller has given us this afternoon, I would like to ask you now about the importance of for all of us of having some grounding in science and ethics. In terms of being literate in those fields, it strikes me that this is something that comes through in Hitler's scientists.
Well, it comes through, I think, particularly in the post-war era, you know, when we went straight from the Second World War into the Cold War, and science, because pretty well all of it could be applied in some way to the great confrontation between the Soviet Union and the West. That is, whether you were talking in military terms or simply the prestige of new discoveries, suddenly it became part of that confrontation, which lasted right up to 1989. There was an idea that was extremely pervasive, I think, but it started during the Second World War, but it continued beyond the end of it, which was that a democracy is the best of all possible worlds for science. And in a curious way, the tradition which had started in Germany, that science, inhabited a world outside of politics, got to continue under democracy in the post-war era. For that reason, that you thought, well, we can trust our governments. We can, a democracy is essentially a good place, and so it's good for science. And for that reason, I think science actually became undemocratized. There's a paradox here. Scientists themselves simply told themselves that they could trust their government. I mean, their governments were not totalitarian. They could trust them to do the best for science. The net result was that you had two things happened, I think. First of all, ordinary people, because science became more and more difficult, simply didn't involve themselves in keeping abreast with science. They thought that was best for the scientists. And scientists, on the other hand, stayed out of politics. And so you had an environment in which science was conducted in a kind of, under an auspices of secrecy. It was almost like another world. I think that the best way in which science can be controlled is by democratizing it. And there are difficulties here because, for example, if we take areas of physics, nuclear physics, quantum physics, and so forth, these are extremely difficult to understand. How do ordinary people express a view about what scientists are doing when they simply find it so difficult to keep up with it? So I'm not denying the problem on the part of all non-scientists, but on the other hand, we simply can't leave the decisions about science to professional politicians on the one hand and to scientists on the other. I mean, we can see this is simply not working. We've all got to get involved. And this is why I think the use of the media and websites and the internet in forming new communities of people who are concerned and want to get involved is essential.
Let's talk with some more listeners. So next we're going to go to a listener on line one, Champagne. Hi.
Hi. My question has to do with, are there any examples where science is performed outside the pale of a military-industrial complex? And I'm thinking of countries maybe like Switzerland, which have been traditionally neutral. And how has science fared there?
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that question. Perhaps, Celeste, you could give it to me in your own words.
He's asking about science performed outside the world of the military-industrial complex, and he mentioned Switzerland as an example.
Yes, and his question is?
How has science fared?
How has science fared outside? How has it done? How has it fared outside?
Yes. Well, Switzerland, of course, is a neutral country and is not engaged in military activities through science. But some of the greatest pharmaceutical companies in the world are based in Switzerland, and they're multinational companies. And so they would not be outside, they might well be outside the military, but they're not outside the industrial complex of science. And let's try to understand a little bit better what the problem is. If you accept that science conducts itself best, that the integrity of science is protected by its freedom, its internationalism, its serendipity, I mean, that means the giving to scientists the opportunity to make mistakes and to discover things by chance, then the stranglehold of the proprietorship of science, say by, you know, major pharmaceutical companies, is not always in the best interest of science. And this is by involving Switzerland. It's a good question about Switzerland, but it reveals just how pervasive this is worldwide. You know, we're a in globalized economy. The operation of the pharmaceutical giants as being the, you know, the shakers and movers of much of what happens in the biological sciences is undeniable, and it's in some cases very deleterious.
Does the listener want to follow up?
No, thanks.
Okay, thank you for your call. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Chicago, line 4. Go ahead.
Hello. I hope I'm not going to go over something you said at the beginning of the discussion, but I can't wait to read your book, because the one question that's always been in my mind is why here in the United States we vilify Hitler and act as if his actions during World War II and prior to World War II were at works of one man, and there's never any mention of the scientists and their horrendous experiments. And after hearing the very first caller, I'm beginning to wonder if the reason why in American culture the scientists themselves were not vilified is because we adopted so much of their work, or because I know in the case of the Japanese scientists that had the biological center in Russia, or I think, or Manchuria, I guess it was, I know that the United States prevented Nuremberg-type trials or war crime trials, and they did keep a lot of that research. So I guess my question is, how much is the work, however heinous, protected, because it fits into the needs of the military industrial complex?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think, and I go to some pains to discuss this in my book, the very best principles relating, for example, to experiments on human beings without consent, which were prompted at the Nuremberg trial, doctor's trial, particularly in relation to people like Joseph Mengele, were adopted and created very largely by American lawyers and ethicists after the war. The point I've had to make in my book is that some of the greatest offenses against the principle, for example, of experiment without consent, have occurred in the United States since the end of the war. One example is the Tungesky experiment on blacks in relation to syphilis, which was not stopped until the mid-1970s. Another was in the 1960s, the release of radioactive materials in order to make tests on the population, again without consent, which was aimed at discovering about similar releases in the Soviet Union. And so it goes on. The British, too, have been guilty of this in their atom bomb testings in the Pacific, where people to this day are still suffering. Now, what this amounts to is a kind of hypocrisy, which we have to come clean about, and which both scientists and non-scientists, you know, need to inform themselves of. But you've raised something else, which I think is tremendously important and often overlooked, that although we profess to despise Nazi science during the war, and although during the Nuremberg trials it was an idea emerged that you should not use or exploit science or the products of science which have been gained by torture and oppression. We, nevertheless, and when I say we, I mean the British and the Americans, carried off a kind of loot from the Second World War, which included whole teams of Nazi scientists, notably Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist, and some 150 of his technicians were brought to the United States, and this became the basis of our space program and the development of ICBMs. I'm not saying that we should have simply destroyed all that technology, but I think that what is important is to acknowledge that there was blood on that technology, and we should understand that.
Well, thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. John Cornwell, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Hitler Scientists, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact. Listeners, we have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program, so if you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. In times of war, in times of great threat, in times of crisis, what is the proper role of the scientist in defending and helping to defend humanity?
This was a question that was raised first, I think, in a major and historic way during the First World War. The scientists in Germany, a great number of them, signed a manifesto which said that science should always be at the service of the nation and the military. And this was said to be the case not only during war, but during peace as well. Science, as all scientists will tell you, is international in nature. There is no such thing as a German physics or an American physics or a French physics. The laws of nature apply to all scientists in all cases. I think, however, that when a country is involved in a war of national survival, as Britain was in the first part of the war before America joined with Britain against Hitler and against the Japanese, it was obviously essential that, because it was going to be a technological war, that scientists should put all their knowledge and their expertise and skills, at the service of the nation. It was also essential that the products of science should be shrouded in secrecy. The question then is, what happens when you reach the end of the war? And as I've said earlier in this program, the great problem for science was that the ownership of science by the military and the pervasiveness of secrecy continued beyond the end of the Second World War, with the justification that we were confronting a perilous situation in relation to the Soviet Union. So I think that, you know, the answer to your question really is, you know, it depends on, you know, where we stand in relation, you know, in a war situation, scientists really have to buckle under, and you can't conduct science in the best possible way during wartime. The war is long over. The Soviet Union has passed, and yet we now live in the post 9/11 mm-hmm. era, back again into a period in which all of science can be seen as either for or against, you know, the defense of the American homeland in the war on terror. And I think that's a very dangerous situation for scientists to be in, and we need to, you know, think very carefully about this and the way and the direction in which we're being taken.
Yeah. Well, scientists are not the only ones who are caught there today. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead. Yes,
okay.
You're on.
I didn't hear the beep. As the daughter of a Swiss, I would just like to say about Switzerland that Switzerland might be neutral, but it is not non-military. Every male Swiss citizen must serve in the military from the age of 19 or 20 until 50. And my relatives have all had big parties when they turned 50 because they didn't have to serve. I think it's 3 weeks every year. It has more weapons per capita, I believe, than any other country in Europe. It's I don't think they're nuclear weapons, but they certainly have weapons. So they're not non-military, and also there's a lot of blood on Swiss hands in terms of Jewish money from World War II. My mother was fond of saying Switzerland was neutral on the side of the Axis. So, you know, I'm very fond of Switzerland, and I have wonderful relatives there, but they're not out of the loop here.
Yes, thank you for reminding us of that, and you are, of course, absolutely right. I think the point I was trying to make, caller, was that I don't think that science at a high level is involved or with you know, the military in Switzerland. The Swiss famously have their People's Army, and they're very, very good at what they do. But I think the idea is that this is a purely defensive posture on the part of the Swiss, and it's not involved in a great complex of highly technical offensive weapons. They're certainly not involved in weapons of mass destruction. And although they're very well armed, and every citizen has access to these arms if they've been in the army or are in the army, it's on the whole kind of old technology. It's not dependent on new high technology.
Well, she's hung up, and I want to thank her for her call this afternoon. We're here at the end of the time that we can spend together today. How have the interviews that you've been doing so far in this country gone?
They've gone very well indeed. I think that this is a topic about which people are really very interested and also very concerned. I think, above all, people are concerned about the fact that the United States is involved in the development of new forms of nuclear weapons, which so-called mini-nukes, for example, and bunker busters, which somehow blur, you know, the distinction between nuclear weapons and conventional weapons. And I think that brings us to a very dangerous kind of situation for the future, because if we start to break the great taboos, you know, in non-proliferation of nuclear, then this invites other countries to do the same, and we could have a massive proliferation in nuclear weaponry as a result of that. I think people know this, they're concerned about it, the media is covering it. You know, what allows a scientist, you know, in his conscience to be working on these things? This is what we have to ask.
There's where we have to leave it. Mr. Cornwell, thank you very much for joining us this
afternoon. Thank you. It'd be my pleasure.
John Cornwell has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Hitler's Scientists, Science, War, and the Devil's Pact. The publisher is Viking.